Funding for Smart Talk is provided by Capital Blue Cross. For 80 years, Capital Blue Cross has offered products that provide peace of mind and promote good health, focused on creating a healthier future for our communities through innovations like its Capital Blue Health and Wellness Centers that provide in-person service and inspire healthy living. Capital Blue Cross is behind you for whatever lies ahead. More information is at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross. Live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle. Its 11 principal investigators and 12 nurse coordinators conduct research efforts to advance cardiovascular medicine. Information at upmcpinnacle.com/myheart.
Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Governor Tom Wolf outlined his proposed 2018-19 fiscal year state budget proposal yesterday. Wolf wants to increase state spending by $1 billion to 3%, or 3%, I should say, to almost $33 billion. The additional funding would go toward public schools, skills training, pension obligations, prison costs, and social services for children, older Pennsylvanians, and those living with a disability. The governor's budget does not seek a personal income or sales tax increase, but for the fourth straight year, does call for a severance tax on natural gas drillers. To discuss the governor's proposals and the state's finances is our guest today, Dr. G. Terry Madonna, professor of public affairs and director of the Center for Politics and Public Affairs at Franklin and Marshall College. He's also director of the Franklin and Marshall College poll. Dr. Madonna, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, maybe you'd like to weigh in on the governor's budget proposal, maybe there's something you think that the state needs to spend more money on or less money, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. And Terry, you know, the weather outside is not exactly conducive. You were going to travel from Lancaster here today, but just glad that you're safe and in the coziness of your home while we can have this conversation. So, Terry, you have covered and listened to a lot of governor's budget addresses over the year. This one was one of the shortest I can remember, 19 minutes. So what was your takeaway?
Yeah, well, let's start with the governor enters the chamber, Scott, and what was fascinating, the House chamber, what was fascinating was he got a very nice ovation, folks standing. It wasn't like the State of the Union.
No.
The recent State of the Union. And throughout the speech, there was no hissing and no booing, and it was just delightful. I mean, that doesn't mean that, you know, Democrats and or Republicans don't have to agree with everything the president, the governor has proposed. But it was nice, you know, to see them listening and watching respectfully and without the, the combative nature that you often find even in the comments afterward by Republicans. You know, they're not going to agree on everything, obviously. But overall, I like the tenor. I like the tenor of it. And given the nature of the budget, which you very accurately described, I don't think we're going to have five continuing resolutions to get the budget through. I'm obviously referring to what's going on with
some people may not know, but on a state level, you can't do that anyway because it has to be a balanced budget.
Correct. Yeah, well, balanced is in the eye of the beholder, as you know. They only borrowed, what, $2 billion in the current budget and shifted money around. It was a dizzying array of transfers. You can't even begin to understand it. And I spend my time, and I know you do. I couldn't begin to explain how they said they balanced the budget last in the current fiscal year.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I hate to sound cynical right off the bat because I agree with you that it was refreshing to not hear the partisanship that you normally hear in Harrisburg, but especially Washington today. But I will bring up the cynical side. The cynical question is, the governor's running for re-election this year. The entire state house is up for election. Half the state senate is up for election. How much did that influence what the governor proposed yesterday in your mind?
I think hugely. This is what, and the governor's office, I think, wouldn't agree with this, but that's fine. I wouldn't expect them to. Almost, you know, this was a realistic election year budget. Again, as you point out, no general tax hikes. There's a niche tax here, the shale tax, if that's what we want to call it. He does call for if you live in a municipality in which you get your police protection from the state police, he wants a $25 per head fee paid, you know, paid for the coverage supplied by the police. I mean, you were looking at things like that, but overall, no general tax hike, which he's called for in previous budgets. The fact of the matter is that I think this budget is going to get tweaked, but basically it's probably going to get approved with the major priorities the governor has in there. The spending $1 billion, I really doubt that the legislature is going to give him $1 billion more, the Republican-controlled legislature, the 3% hike. But I think the priorities the governor set out are popular with Republicans and Democrats.
And I have a clip from the very beginning of the governor's speech yesterday, not the part having to do with the Super Bowl champion Eagles that got a standing ovation when the governor was wearing an Eagles cap. But this is just a little bit later when he started talking about the progress that his administration has made over the last 4 years. And I want to get your take on this.
What was standing in our way wasn't our work ethic or our entrepreneurial spirit, but a kind of political paralysis. A status quo in which too often politicians here in Harrisburg simply couldn't find a way to make the tough decisions and smart investments we would need to get back on track. So I promised that I'd challenge that status quo here in Harrisburg. And that's what I've tried to do for the last 3 years. Sometimes that meant challenging the legislature to step out of its comfort zone. Sometimes we've worked our way to a compromise. Sometimes I've been forced to move forward on my own. We still have a lot of work to do, but taking on the status quo here in Harrisburg and doing that, we've already begun to write a new story for our Commonwealth.
Well, Terry, there are several questions I have out of those remarks. First of all, the governor seems to be describing a situation in Harrisburg that has changed, a culture change over the last 4 years during his administration. Would you say that we've gone that far?
Yeah, I don't know that I'd say we've gone that far, but you noticed a word that infused his comments, we. This was very much a bipartisan speech aimed at an appeal, a compromising, easygoing style up there in which he made it clear, Scott, that when they didn't act, he was prepared where he could, you know, legally, to act on his own. And throughout the course of his tenure, even though he proposed things that the Republicans weren't going to agree to, particularly tax hikes and the shale tax, and in some cases larger spending, the fact of the matter is that he emphasized a consensus where he could reach it. But he was also clear that where he could, if they didn't act and he had the legal authority, he would act on his own. And he cited a couple instances in the speech in which he did that. But again, I think he has argued that there are big cultural huge changes that have taken place in his approach and in state government. I wouldn't go that far, certainly, but you understand why the governor, A, is going to put the best foot forward, B, why he's going to be optimistic. And later on talked about things they had done together, the Republicans and the governor, and also Democrats, and talked about things that they could do.
It hasn't exactly been, whether it's been a lot of cooperation, a huge amount of cooperation. Remember, we just went through a budget standoff that lasted 3 months past the deadline.
Right.
The governor's first year in office, it went 9 months. I mean, there are probably a lot of people who were listening to the governor's speech yesterday said, didn't we just finish this process? I mean, but that should remind people that what the governor's budget address is this is a blueprint. the legislature is going to maybe take some parts of it and,
sure,
you know, go from there.
Sure.
Republicans, as you pointed out, Terry, Republicans afterwards in the legislature, the leaders, were not as critical as in past years either. I mean, there are a couple of things they didn't like. One was this shale tax. I mean, they really didn't even address that. It was because they kind of looked at it as a non-starter, not going to happen. But the $1 billion spending increase.
Right.
Now, this is Senate Majority Leader Jay Corman, what he had to say about that.
We're going to have to find a significant amount of reductions in spend that he proposed here today. But this is the beginning.
So even then, Senator Corman said, this is the beginning. But, you know, that spending increase, not surprisingly, is what Republicans, if they were going to be critical, that's what they were critical of.
Oh, sure. And Governor Wolf has also proposed something that he's been pushing for some time, and that's a $12 an hour minimum wage. I really think that's not likely to occur as well. You know, you don't know on any one of these whether there'll be some kind of a compromise worked out. But this is an election year budget. Heck, I argued last year, and I think when we chatted about it over the period of time after the governor proposed it February a year ago, that was an election year budget. Remember, he only called then for a 1.8% hike. And the taxes were niche taxes, not general taxes. So this is an approach that I think the governor has become, in a sense, realistic. So what does he want to do? What do governors want to do when they have a legislature in the other party that's not likely to give him, you know, everything that he wants or some of the big things? So what do? They put them forward, but they understand they're not going to get them. And they can try to negotiate from there to get something of a compromise or something else that they might want. You know, that's just the way the process works. But you're exactly right. Senator Corman and other Republicans, you didn't get kind of the fierce criticism. If this were Democrats reacting to a Republican president, you know what that would have been like, as we have seen in D.C., but none of that acrimony. And I don't think they carry a disdain or a dislike for Governor Wolf. You can disagree with him, but he doesn't have his style is, I'll say this tongue-in-cheek, somewhat professorial, collegial. You know, he's not the kind of guy, even if you disagree with him, your hands clutch up, you know what I mean, and you're clawing at something. That's not the way I think people, and maybe I'll ask you that question. You've interviewed. Do you think that's the way people react to him?
Yeah, and he's not confrontational.
Yeah.
He's not confrontational at all. Now, you know, behind closed doors, there's been some times, and even in some budget addresses, remember just a few years ago when he told Republicans to get on board or maybe find another job.
Oh, yeah, he chewed him out. Yeah. So, again, this is an election year budget, and one of the things, I mean, that I was impressed with was he went out of his way to stress harmony, to use the word we. He talked about things that they had done together. And I'm not saying that every Republican was on board, but he talked about what he considered to be successes of his first term that they had accomplished together. Pension reform, alcohol expansion, and you probably had the Speaker of the House, Mike Terzai, jumping up and down with glee at that one. Medical marijuana. And there's a consensus, maybe not on always how much to spend or how to accomplish it, but there's a bipartisan consensus, as there is among the public, that we have an opioid crisis and it needs to be dealt with. And the budget calls for additional spending on that.
I want to talk more about some of the specifics of the governor's budget proposal in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
Smart Talk is supported by Capital Blue Cross, providing health care coverage accepted by doctors and specialists in all 50 states. More information is available at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC Pinnacle, committed to reducing hospital-acquired infections and readmission rates. More information on UPMC Pinnacle's achievements in patient safety can be found at upmcpinnacle.com/quality.
Our guest today is Dr. G. Terry Medina, political analyst from Franklin and Marshall College. We're talking about Governor Tom Wolf's budget proposal yesterday for the fiscal year that starts July 1st, 2018, goes until June 30th, 2019. If you have a question or a comment, you'd like to weigh in on the governor's spending priorities, things that maybe you'd like to see the state spend more on or on less, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a message on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at smarttalkwitf. Again, it's 1-800-729-7532. All right, Terry, so let's get into some of the specifics of the things that we've talked about so far. What do you think is most significant about what the governor proposed yesterday? The spending increase, more money for education, just what?
Well, I think obviously if the bulk of the new spending comes on in education and workforce development, and what the governor did, he proposed to spend $225 million for education spending without getting, you know, too much into minutiae. That would be $100 million for basic ed, $20 million for special education, $30 million for pre-K counts, $10 million for Head Start, and $15 million for the PASHE system, for the Pennsylvania System of Higher Education. And then he wants to do workforce development. He what he did in this speech and his address, you know, 19 minutes long, one of the, I think maybe the shortest I've ever heard, what he basically attempted to do was to tie the importance of education and an aspect of it, workforce development, which does involve the component of education, to train workers for the 21st century jobs. He tied those two together in order to continue with Pennsylvania's job growth, economic growth. So I think what he did, Scott, was to combine those two things in a way that was not arguably very appealing. Again, we can argue about, you know, and the lawmakers will, about the amount of spending in each one of those, but the combination of the things, it's, in my humble judgment, was irresistible. Now, I had some other things in there that we can talk about, but overall, I think that was the linchpin of what he's trying to do. He also pointed out that we added 180,000 jobs since he became governor. That's not unusual for a governor to tout, you know, whatever economic success occurred during his administration.
Even though there are, you know, we know that across the country, jobs have been added, so that's not unique to Pennsylvania. In fact, if I did hear a criticism from Republicans yesterday, one of the criticisms was that Pennsylvania needs to create more jobs. Of course, they're going to say that, I say they, meaning any politician, no matter what party, is going to say that every year. So let's get back to education for a moment. This is one of the promises that the governor ran on 4 years ago, was that he would restore funding to where it had been during the Corbett administration, after the federal money had been cut. Remember, that's what Governor Corbett said, is that, you know, we didn't add this money. The state didn't add this money. This is money that come from the federal that came from the federal government, that was a one-time deal. Don't rely on it. School districts did, in his mind. But anyway, Democrats, Governor Wolf said that those were cuts. So every year that he has proposed a budget, there has been an increase in education spending. But there are a lot of, if you look at figures across the state, many, many school districts have continued to increase their property taxes. So even though there's more money coming from the state, they're still, you know, local taxpayers, school districts are asking local taxpayers to pay more. I know pension is a big reason for that, but the simple question would be, why?
Well, because expenses to operate the schools have gone up. There are mandates and requirements that schools have to meet. You know, pensions is certainly one of them. Schools have new requirements, curricular requirements. Some would argue, and of course you don't want to ask a teacher, a college professor about this, but some critics say the salaries of teachers are a cause. You can go and look at administrators. But I think overall it's the demand that exists for schools going through a huge change, with testing and a whole variety of other things so that the cost of education has gone up. Again, the critics would say that schools need to bring their cost into line, but you know, and most, and I'm sure many of your listeners know, that, that a heavy proportion of the funding comes from one of the most unfair taxes and the most unpopular tax in the state, and that's the property tax. And so that's another aspect of it. And it's one area where local school districts, you know, in 500 school districts in our state, that they can control. Local school boards can't control what the state gives them, but they can raise property taxes and, as you accurately point out, often do.
And so the question has to be asked, even though the state has provided hundreds of millions of dollars more over the last 4 years, I'm sure it's made a difference. I mean, because there were school districts that were laying off teachers, were cutting programs. But have we been able to keep ahead of it with, you know, the rising cost that school districts are facing?
Oh, no, you're exactly right. I mean, and there's more and more every session in the legislature, there are calls to do property tax reform. We're talking about $11 billion. $11 billion. Now, you have seen the estimates, as I have, about the huge hike in income and or sales taxes that would have to be used if we went to a system where the state taxes are responsible to fund the schools, something that, by the way, local school boards and local school district people aren't enamored with for reasons we can talk about. But you're exactly right. I mean, and the other point you made is really relevant, and that is the governor ran, and throughout the course of the campaign in 2014, education was the number one priority that he set. Obviously, at that point, it was still the economy, stupid, let's get the economy moving. I'm quoting James Carville there, not the governor, in terms of the linkage between the two.
Mm. Let's take a phone call from Tom in Edders. Tom, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our state representative is real keen on this idea of transferring money from established accounts into the general fund.
Right.
And is that part of the present budget setup? And how do they do this? They actually just take all that money from these accounts, or do they borrow the money from the accounts? I can't understand what is going on. Maybe you can explain it to
me. All right. Thank you very much for your call, Tom. And this kind of goes back to one of the proposals that was made by a group of Republican legislators last summer when we were in the midst of the budget impasse. Obviously, it was something that the governor didn't support, and it's not part of this budget. But I think what Tom is looking for is how that could actually be done, because maybe it's something that will be looked at in the future, Terry.
Yeah. Well, as you know, there are funds that have reserved accounts in them, and these funds just can get transferred around. And I think that's what the caller is referring to. And whether it takes place in this budget remains to be seen. The fiscal situation is a lot different in that there's no looming $2.2 billion budget deficit. I'm not as convinced that the $2 billion in borrowing, and they did some movement of monies around to balance the current fiscal year's budget. I'm not as convinced that they won't come back to haunt us and that we truly do not have a deficit. But having said that, it's complicated, but they can take money out of reserved accounts, and they can take money out of funds, operating funds where there are surpluses, and move them around and put them in other areas of the budget. And I think that's what the caller is referring to.
Let's take a call from Bud in Northern York. Bud, you're on the air.
Hello. Yes, I have a question or a comment. I'd like someone to take and check into why we have so many administrators in all our state universities. I think a couple of them probably have more administrators than we have professors.
Okay. Thank you very much for your call. I don't know how much that would save if we were more efficient that way. But I think overall, and you could maybe expand Bud's question into other areas other than just state universities.
Yeah. Well, let's take that. As you know, I was a professor at Millersville University.
I know. Well, you're a private institution now.
Yeah,
so.
I know. But, you know, I'm an alum of a public university, too. So, if you ask the faculty on a college campus, what do you think they're going to say about how many administrators
exactly.
there
That's,
are?
I wondered about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just something that faculty, and it, often it's jocular, you know what I mean. I've not done an extensive study of the number of administrators. I think what's going on in colleges and universities in general, and it's I'm not suggesting it's not a good question, it is we've got a ton of new programs that have developed over the years. I mean, you can look in virtually every area of academe and find some of them are in student services, some of them are in academic programs, some of them are in outreach, some of them are in programs. And so these programs need administrators. Or sometimes they're faculty who are teaching half-time and, you know, doing the administrative work part-time. Some of them have to do with the variety of requirements that they get from state government or from the federal government for programs that they're supposed to implement. So I won't go on this too much further. But I always take in the view that there's nothing wrong with having good, solid studies of the personnel in any organization to find out what are the needs, what functions can be combined or in some cases eliminated, and I don't know that we do that enough.
You kind of touched on this, but the governor gave it a name yesterday, a new initiative, $50 million initiative, focusing on career and technical education called PA Smart.
Right.
I have talked about this with guests on this program a lot lately because just yesterday morning, I moderated, an event, an economic forecast for the Harrisburg Chamber and Critique. And one of the questions asked of those in the room who are business people, employers, is how many of you are having trouble finding employees? One third of the audience of about 300 raised their hands. And, the keynote speaker, who is an economist with PNC, said that I've been in audiences where up to 75% of the hands went up. We have a real problem now, not in Pennsylvania, but across the country, with finding skilled workers.
Correct.
$50 million does not sound like a whole lot. I mean, yeah, that's a lot of money, but in comparison to these other things.
Right.
So I think the recognition that we have to do more to turn out skilled workers is a good one, but I wonder whether that's enough money for it.
Well, obviously that's a debate that I think is seriously worth happening. I think you're exactly right. The economy of the future depends on having a workforce that can align with the way in which technology has changed the world. You're exactly right about that. And even some colleges and universities, one in our state, Slippery Rock, out in the western part of the state, a public university, has gotten into a lot of these technical programs in order to supplement, the workforce needs. But we need a systematic plan, and I think what the governor has done in the PA Smart program, it's a new initiative, and it's trying to get state agencies to interact and cooperate together in order to beef up skilled training activities. It also has to, and I think you would agree, it also has to include the private sector. So this is one area where the private sector and the government can work together. You're just not going to be able to accomplish it with public monies. Private monies need to be included, but the success of the economy, not just of our state, but of the United States, is aligning the workforce, making sure that it's educated, making sure that the technical skills are there in order to succeed in the 21st century. That should be a number one priority of state government. And whether, obviously more money, that one of the things they could do is put more money into the college, universities and colleges that are doing the technical education.
Yeah,
and
community colleges,
Thaddeus Stevens
School of Technology.
Stevens. Yep.
A lot of the schools that are offering it.
But I don't think anyone could disagree that this ought to be a number one priority of state government. And again, working in conjunction with the business community.
You know, Terry, you know, I understand that I'm talking to someone who is on the faculty of a public institution, and you know, but let me just put it this way. One of the things I've heard from many of our guests when talking about this is that we have an attitude in this country. We've encouraged our students, our high school students, that the road to success is a four-year degree, and then maybe going on to postgraduate and that kind of thing. And it, you know, if you look at the salary figures over the year, it certainly points out that that is very, very helpful. But at the same time, what has happened is almost put a stigma on not getting
technical,
a degree.
Yeah.
And that's something that we have to get away from.
I could not agree with you more. Look, not everyone needs to pursue a four-year college degree. There are tremendous opportunities, and there should be more opportunities to get the technical and the trade education to go and earn a good living. I don't want to change the subject matter here, but one of the reasons that Donald Trump carried the state of Pennsylvania and the other Rust Belt states was his discussion about manufacturing and trade. Now, he didn't do it in the sense of workforce development the way we're having a discussion, but there are folks, many of them in the southwestern part of our state, up in the northeastern part, and in Ohio and Wisconsin and Michigan. I obviously mentioned those states for an important reason, that they're responsible for putting Trump in the White House. But the workers whose ancestors worked in the mines, in the mills, and in the manufacturing sector of our economy recognize that job training and job skills are essential in order to bring back manufacturing. So you're exactly right about that. And we have hundreds of thousands of Pennsylvanians who could use those skills if trained. So I think we need not just the state, but a federal program designed to beef them up. And not everybody has to go to college. And it shouldn't just apply into where the old mining and mill towns were, where coal and iron and steel and lead and all of those once predominated. But what's wrong with the inner cities?
Right. These are good-paying jobs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What's wrong with these kinds of programs being adapted for both the cities of our country and our state, and the rural and small towns as well?
Yeah. Let's take a phone call from Pat in Mount Joy. Pat, you're on the air. Pat, are you there?
Yes. Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
It's my understanding that when the state raised the gasoline tax, it did so in order to pay for infrastructure, like fixing the roads and bridges, and that those monies are being siphoned off in order to pay for the state police.
Right.
And that meanwhile, there's a $25 per head tax that the state is unwilling to levy for those municipalities that don't have their own police force. Your comments, is that true?
Thank you very much, Pat. Go ahead. You mentioned earlier, but that was a part of the governor's budget address yesterday, was that $25 tax or fee, however you want to refer to it.
Right. The thrust of the point the callers make is accurate. I mean, as you know, the wholesale gasoline tax was lifted several years ago, and that was producing about $2 billion a year that's going into our roads and bridges. And there isn't any doubt that there have been some successes at that. I don't think you can argue. The governor pointed out that there were something like 1,060 bridges, that have been repaired, and that there was 18,000 miles of roadways that have been repaved and, resurfaced and repaired in general. But one of the concerns that the folks who are in that industry have is the money that's been transferred out of it to support the state police. And that wasn't the original intent of lifting the wholesale gasoline tax. Your caller is exactly right on that. And so figuring out a way to fund the state police adequately is important. Now, I'm going to let somebody else decide whether the municipalities that don't, that use state police for their security don't put up, aren't paying for it, and whether there should be a $25 per head fee, which we'll see what the legislature does with it, remains to be seen. Obviously, those communities are often rural and in small town, and you know, they're going to argue they don't have the money to do that. But be that as it may, it's an issue that does need to be resolved, the state police funding.
Yeah, I mean, just for some historical perspective, this came during the administration of Governor Tom Corbett.
Correct.
And was probably looked at as, you know, one of his biggest accomplishments is
right.
to get that legislation passed, that finally the state would be dealing with these deficient bridges and roadways and all that. But then, as you described, you know, it started going towards state police because there are so many municipalities across this state that don't have their own police departments
right.
and state police cover it for them. Now, that $25, that was something that the governor proposed last year, $25 per head in those municipalities that where state police do the coverage. And, you know, their comeback has been, Terry, that, well, you know, if we could afford to do that, we'd have our own police departments.
Yeah,
we wouldn't need
right.
the state police.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And, I mean, there was a map I saw that pinpointed the municipalities. I can't, you know, I looked at it, I think, months ago, so I don't know if I'm going to be entirely accurate. And a majority of them, as you would expect, are in, you know, rural parts of the state in particular. But there were a couple I noticed that were that I thought were in areas of the state where the municipalities might be able to afford it. They probably never, over the course of what? Over the course of time, didn't provide their own police. The state police were doing it, so you know what I mean. They never decided to create their own, establish their own police force. But that's something. I mean, there's another example of what often happens in state government, where the legislature does something. There's an agreement at one point that the funds would go one place, and they end up being diverted. Now, certainly not all of them, but a sufficient amount of that gets diverted. Again, I can't remember how much it is, but it's in, if I could be wrong, but I think it's in the hundreds of millions.
Oh, yeah, it is. It is.
450, 500 million, but I wouldn't stand on that. But there's a significant amount of that money that gets moved over. And again, the state police need to be adequately funded. I think we would all agree with that.
Yeah, I think everyone would. But as far as what this has to do with, you know, in this legislature, last year when the governor proposed this, it was basically a non-starter.
Correct.
And think about this, that most of the legislators across the state come from rural areas, rural districts, so
right.
areas where this wouldn't be very popular. So I'm not going to ask you to predict, but do you think it would be taken any more seriously by the legislature this year?
I would be, let me put it this way, I would be surprised if the legislature passes it in an election year. How's that?
Okay.
If they didn't pass it in a non-election year, they're not going to do anything overly controversial. And as I like to put it, they get involved in these things, that's much less likely to cause a budget delay. But you know, the last thing that lawmakers want to do in an election year is to stay in Dodge. Actually, I'm referring to that state capital along the Susquehanna River. They don't want to remain there one day after June 30, right? They don't want to be there and face the criticism. But as I like to put it, having covered a lot of these, just as you have, the real deadline for the state budget is not June 30 constitutionally, but the real deadline is after the fourth holiday, July 4th holiday, because the voters of the state are doing what we all do over the fourth weekend, right? They're not worried about the passage of a state budget, but July 5th they do.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. We are talking about Governor Wolf's state budget proposal yesterday with Dr. G. Terry Madonna, Franklin and Marshall College political analyst. If you would like to weigh in, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. Terry, I want to go back to the natural gas severance tax. Governor Wolf has proposed this every year since he has been mm-hmm. in his office. He campaigned on it for the first time. Yesterday, I heard one of the leaders in Republican, one of the Republican legislative leaders, right off the bat, kind of dismissed it as, okay, that's
right.
not going to happen because we're not going to kill jobs in the state, already have an impact fee. You know, the governor has the knowledge that that probably is not something that has a whole lot of chance in an election year. Why propose it?
Because it's popular with the voters. In poll after poll, the ones we've done at F&M and the ones that have been done elsewhere, Chris Bork up at Muhlenberg has done them, there isn't any doubt that it's popular. And the way I view this, and if you look at it realistically, this isn't so much a party deal. In other words, Republican versus Democrat, it's a regional deal. So if you're out in the southwestern part of the state, down that Appalachian chain where the shale industry is big, or along Route 80, if you get the map and you look at where the fracking is taking place, you find lawmakers, Democrat or Republican, from those regions who aren't going to vote for it. But you get down to the southeastern part of our state, and particularly in the Philly burbs and in the Lehigh Valley, you're going to find Democrats who, and more importantly, Republicans who think differently about it. In other words, that are prepared to vote for it. So the question is not just party oriented, although let's be honest, more Democrats would support it than Republicans. There isn't any doubt about it. And you do have Republicans from out of the shale area who say no, just because they don't want the tax, they don't want the price of natural gas to go up. And we're the only state that doesn't have one that does fracking, but we're the only state that has an impact fee. And the other point that's relevant is the people who oppose it, the Republicans who oppose it, are also going to mention that right now, because of what's happening with natural gas and the expansion of new wells, that the impact fee is generating more revenue for the Commonwealth. That's another aspect of this that I think we're increasingly going to hear more about.
Opioids. The governor has been out front. The legislature has, too. I think that this is a bipartisan issue, obviously.
Right.
What the governor proposed yesterday, $26.5 million in Federal Cures Act funding to expand treatment services. I mean, not a day goes by that we don't hear about overdose deaths in this state and across the country. Even in some of our counties here in central Pennsylvania, some of the most overdose deaths. It has been legitimately and accurately described as a crisis. So what more can state government do about it?
Well, I think what needs to happen, I mean, you're exactly right. Let me just add that it's hard to find, a nuclear family, and then you get out to the extended family that's not been affected by it personally. I mean, that's how broad-based it is. I think what has to happen is we need the coordination. And here's where the state government can take the lead. We need the coordination with the business community, with the medical community, to coordinate a program, a series of activities and programs. Again, not all necessarily state-generated and state-paid for, to get an overall societal approach to deal with the problem. It's not an easy problem to resolve because of the availability of so many kinds of opioids. Prescribed, some illegally arrived, and the fact that you move to other drugs, particularly heroin, that often gets cited. So it's not going to be an easy problem to resolve, but it's one that's going to take more than state government. It's going to take the business community, the medical community, and what I hear on my shameless self-promotion when I have people on Pennsylvania Newsmakers to talk about this, the business folks say, uh-oh. It's not just a question of hiring people, and we talked about that, in the aspect of the skills and the trade, but it's also about the cost just in the personal lives of people affected. But it's also adding to a huge cost to the business community.
Well, and, unfortunately, there have been a number of employers, a lot of employers across the state that say that one of the issues, the hurdles to finding workers is passing a drug test.
And then again, once they get into work, the loss of efficiency, the time loss, and what it does to the businesses in both human terms and in financial terms, you're exactly right. Yeah, I've had people on Newsmakers, and we've tried to get to the heart of that, but I'm absolutely convinced that this has to be a societal approach, that, government can play a role, but unless we all get on board in some way with, community activity, municipality activity, government, business across a broad spectrum, it's going to be difficult to resolve.
Let's take a call from Scott in Bethel. Scott, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
Your show.
Thank you.
My comments are regarding the natural gas tax that's being extracted from our state. I agree. It's got to be popular. You would think that that this would be a no-brainer revenue generator. So that's my comment on that. And now I want to ask about some reform. One guy called and talked about administrators. What about consolidating some school districts? What about shrinking the size of the legislature? If we ever really want to do anything about some real reform in the state, both of those things need to be on the table.
Hey, Scott, thank you very much for your call. He touched on several issues there, but
yeah.
Let's start with reducing the size of the legislature, because there actually was some action on the legislation that was in Harrisburg about shrinking the size of at least the House.
No, then they added the Senate, right?
Yeah.
And that's doomed to fail. I mean, if you want to kill the bill, reduce the Senate, you know, from 50. What is it? It go down to 38? I was all caught up in the budget yesterday and didn't even realize they had done that. A House bill would have to go to the Senate, and that's certainly a way to kill it. I mean, plus, I think when you add the Senate, I'm not sure you don't have to go back in another session and do it. Remember, the constitutional amendment has to pass both houses of the legislature in two consecutive sessions before it goes to the voters. I think what the House did was to put a killer amendment in it.
And, you know, again, the cynical amongst us, you know, I've read comments online on social media, people saying, well, no surprise the surprise was that the legislation had made it this far through the legislature.
Yeah.
I mean, you're basically asking some legislators to vote to kill some jobs in the legislature. But then, you know, again, saw the comments that said, well, no surprise, it's not going to make it through. And you're right.
Yeah.
I mean, it takes two consecutive terms,
right,
and then would have to be on a ballot for voters to vote on it. So it doesn't look real promising right now.
No, I think that. And here's some rural lawmakers make the point that what you would do, I think it would expand the rural districts by House districts, you know, or all districts. So you had 25, 30,000 people. That means communicating with their folks, driving for hours around a district. They make the sort of the geography argument. Now, in the burbs and in the cities, it wouldn't make it probably that much of a difference. So that's an argument that they use. I'm not going to get into whether that's a legitimate argument or not. But we have, and I presume your listeners are aware of this, we have the second largest legislature in the country. The largest is New Hampshire, and they're part-time.
Yeah.
So we have the largest full-time. And the cost, I think, generally, depending on how you want to look at it, is, $450 million, $500 million. So out of a $33 billion budget, it's not that much in terms of the overall cost yearly. But people point out the cost. They cite that. They cite the pensions. And they also cite some of the behavior that goes on that we've all been talking about for many, many years as something that's not always popular with the voters.
Now, he also mentioned consolidation of schools. We're near the end of the program. I wish we could talk more about that. That was something proposed by Governor Ed Rendell
right. More
than a decade ago. We all know we have so many schools. We have 500 school districts. We have
right.
2,500 municipalities. Pennsylvania is so different when it comes to kind of protecting
right.
our own, but that is worth a conversation sometime. Let's take a call from Tom in Lemoyne. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott.
Hi.
And thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Hey, I just wanted to comment about the jobs thing, sort of as maybe a closing comment here. The gentleman did say that you know, it has to be a societal shift, and I think I agree that we do need a paradigm shift, just generally speaking, in terms of working class jobs. You know, if people can't find employees, maybe they need to revisit their strategy for that and offer, you know, better paying jobs. And meanwhile, back at the ranch, the employee has to be committed too. You know, if they're not making a living wage, I mean, an employee commitment starts with some security.
Mm.
And if somebody's not making a living wage, then maybe they're not going to be all that invested, you know? So I think there does have to be a societal shift. I think it's just a paradigm shift that everybody has to be on board with.
Hey, thank you very much for your call. And I'm going to be quick with this, Terry, but the caller also told our call screener that he supported the governor's proposal for increasing the minimum wage.
Yep.
One thing that has happened, because there are employers who are having trouble finding workers, wages are starting to go up.
That's correct. And to the caller's point, the technical training that folks would get, the skills training, they would undoubtedly move into jobs that paid for more than the minimum wage. I mean, that would be the point, given the nature of the workforce. But we're going to have this debate over the $12 minimum wage. It's going to go on. I agree with you. I'm a little skeptical that the legislature is likely to do anything about it.
Let's take one more call. We have about a minute left. Larry, you're in Liverpool.
Yeah, thanks a lot. You got to make money to spend money, and all he ever talks about is spending money. This state needs to make money, and there's tons of ways, in my opinion, they could make money. The easiest way is to enforce the law. You got people, I drive on the thruway, the highways and everything around here. I do not see hardly any state troopers, and you got people flying by me at 85, 90 miles an hour going in and out of traffic. Like, no big deal. I've had my wife take a video one time, and the trooper said, well, there's nothing I can do with that. And I said, are you freaking kidding me? They crossed the double yellow line and they passed me, you know?
If they can see, then it's okay.
Hey,
but
thank you. I'm almost out of time.
And put the money back in the system and put the troopers on the road. I go through New York State. You got troopers at every other exit.
Hey, I have to cut you off. Thank you very much. I don't know, Terry, whether a lot of Pennsylvanians would be on board with generating money through fines. But
but the driving habits of Americans have really changed.
Yeah.
It's dreadful. Cutting people off, the speeding. I mean, you get on the highways and the byways and you just cringe.
Yeah. Hey, Terry Madonna from Franklin Marshall College, we're almost out of time. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, my friend.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro suing over net neutrality. Also, a discussion of the volatile stock market.
Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a trusted resource in our communities. Capital Blue Cross, live fearless. Smart Talk is also supported by the team of cardiologists, surgeons, nurses, physicians assistants, and rehabilitation specialists from Pinnacle Health Cardiovascular Institute, part of UPMC Pinnacle, delivering a broad range of traditional and highly specialized procedures.